Last morning, yesterday, I promised I'll say some more about the thousand petal lotus and going inside. The nice part of that simile, or that metaphor, is that it shows you how to proceed in the meditation. The next stage of meditation is never somewhere else. You don't go on to something else. You always go inside where you already are. And this present moment just develops by itself. And one of the stories which shows you how this actually happens, just using mindfulness and kindness and nothing else, was that story when I went to the Zen monastery. It must have been 1972 or 3 or something. Because in those days in UK, there weren't that many places you could go to do a meditation retreat. So I didn't care what type of tradition it was, as long as you could sit there quietly and do some meditation, and I was very happy. And so this was a Zen tradition. And those Zen traditions, they would come behind you with the Zen stick. That's what they called it. It looked like any other type of stick to me. And if you were nodding in the early morning, or in the late morning, or the afternoon, or any old time, they would walk past you, and they would just tap you very lightly on the shoulder, and then whack on the back. I never got hit. Never once. You know the reason why? I've always been very fortunate with good karma from the past. So, the fellow sitting next to me got hit. And after that, I wasn't sleepy at all. I was terrified. And it was the fear which overcame my sleepiness. But anyway, of course, you can't do that anymore because that is violence, especially in our modern age. But one of those nice funny stories was when I was in Hong Kong and staying in one of these temples where so many visitors would come and stay for a few days and then go somewhere else. And so a couple of monks came from mainland China, and we were just chatting around and having a cup of tea or something. And they were telling me that they even had to stop that tradition in mainland China now. Because what happened was there was the Zen monk teaching a retreat, and one of the middle-aged ladies was nodding. So he whacked her on the back with a Zen stick. And immediately, she wasn't very happy. She got out her iPhone, called the police, and the police arrested the monk, and they took him away. I don't want to get arrested, so I'm not going to try hitting you on the back. That was a true story. You can't do that these days. But one good thing about that Zen retreat, because I didn't know exactly what I was meant to do, and they wouldn't tell you, what you were supposed to do, but I had my basic meditation from all the other things which I'd learned over the years. So what we had to do, sitting in just a very narrow hall on either side of the entryway in between, and we were having to just face the wall with our eyes open. There's no windows there, it was actually an old barn before. And they turned it into a meditation hall, what they called a zendo. And we were sitting there, eyes open, and just staring at the wall. What do you do? Just stare. So it's just staring at the wall. And because I knew how to at least be in the present moment and be silent, just to calm the mind down with the eyes open. And then what happened was the wall disappeared. It vanished, which was so cool. Sometimes people would be scared. Who took the wall away? Of course, no one took. My eyes were wide open. I could still I hadn't closed my eyes, I was still conscious. But where there was once a solid wall, there was nothing. And it was so curious that I wanted to find out what is going on. So then I had something to contemplate, to explore the vanishing wall. And it wasn't some sort of trick. All it was is just the way your five senses work. That if you're seeing something and it's always there and it doesn't move, after a while, the brain turns off. That particular sense, click, it stops. So what was happening? The wall was still there because I was still silent, really paying attention, and the wall wasn't moving. Then the sense of sight turned off. And I thought, this is a very wonderful experience, but also it's just so natural. When you meditate and you close your eyes now, I can see the inside of my eyelids. But if I keep my eyes closed, after a few seconds, I won't be able to see anything. Even the inside of my eyelids will disappear. Because whatever is stable, doesn't move, doesn't change, your brain is so efficiently wired, it doesn't see it anymore. Your brain is only programmed to notice things which change. I'll give you another example, this time physical feeling. Can you be aware now of the saliva in your throat? You weren't aware of it a few moments ago, but now it's there. Now let it go. And you can't do it, because once you pay attention on it, you mess it up. After a few moments, so the saliva, by putting attention on it, what you do, we take control of it. And so the saliva is not natural anymore. You know, the feeling of saliva in your throat. And so because it's not natural, it comes and goes, it changes this way and that way, and it means that it does not disappear. So can you still feel the saliva in your throat? I can. So put your attention on something else. Don't worry about the saliva, and then that eventually will just disappear. Of course, there are some people who have a lot of problems when they're meditating because there's so much saliva comes out of their mouth. Sometimes they even dribble. I don't know why, but that happened to me sort of a few weeks. I don't know why that happened, but there is a solution to that. If you're meditating, you get too much saliva and it, you know, it starts to dribble, and you don't want to swallow because that will disturb the meditation. Oh, well. Then there is a solution to that. And the solution, I got this when I went to see my dentist. It's one of these little things you put it in your mouth and goes. That will stop the problem with saliva. However, it's just so noisy. But no, the point was that if something doesn't move, it disappears from your consciousness. So similar to your computer screens. If you don't click any mouse, the screen sort of turns off. First of all, it goes into the default picture, and then even the default picture just stops. The machine turns itself off. That is your brain. If nothing is happening, it turns off. So, what do we really want to turn off? Our body. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. Click, 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 turn them all off. To find out the sixth sense, your mind, what it is. So once upon a time, a long time ago, actually not very long ago, there was an emperor or an empress. I don't know actually who was inside. It could have been artificial intelligence, who knows. And the only time you saw this powerful being who ruled so much of your happiness and suffering was when they were clothed head to toe in his huge boots, and the boots went past the knees up to their thighs. On top of that was the trousers, and the trousers overlapped the top of the boots and went high up past the navel, the belly button. And on top of that was a jacket which overlapped the top of the trousers, with arms going right to the wrists and a high collar. On top of that, there were gloves which overlapped the wrists of the jacket. And on the top, on the head, there was a huge helmet which overlapped the top of the jacket. So there was no part of that emperor you could see because of the five pieces of clothing. The boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves, and the helmet. So no one knew who this powerful emperor was, whether the emperor was a male or a female or in between, whether it was an animal or whether it was an alien from outer space. There are aliens, you know. Aliens do exist. I proved this when I went to UK. You know what's coming next, don't you? Yeah, you know, they were accused there. They said, anyone a UK or not EU citizen or from Europe or something, and then there was one for aliens. You go there, you see, he's got alien mind. But you don't know who this emperor is inside, whether it's tall or short, old or young, African, Asian, Western. You don't know who it was. So, such a powerful emperor, the only way you can find out their identity is to take all their clothes off. And then you can find who they truly are. And in that simile, the emperor is your mind. You've already asked many times, just where is the mind? What is the mind? I can give you some answers, but is that really convincing? It's never as convincing as when you take off all the clothes covering your mind. The five pieces of clothing: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. Your five senses. When you take those off, when they stop, you're still alive. You're still conscious, really aware now. But you're just aware of the emperor, the mind. So is the mind male or female? Of course it's neither of those. Male or female is with your body. Is it old or young? It's very old. To get to know this emperor, this thing inside which does so much, and find out what it is, who it is, if it is anybody. And then you have a huge amount of wisdom and understanding. So what we needed to do, and this is what that experience with the Zen monastery and the wall disappearing, was to see if I can close down these senses. Close them down, stop them, so they disappear, and see what's left. So the path of meditation is closing down the senses, which is why in that simile of the thousand petal lotus, you look at the outermost layer of petals, which is the body, and you know it doesn't matter what type of body you've got. Just relax it. Let it just be. And after a while, it vanishes. If you're sitting pretty still, not moving, you can't get the body to truly vanish. I mean, really go. A lot of it can go, but most of it stays if you're doing the walking meditation, sitting meditation, or lying down meditation sometimes. Or even, remember my predecessor, Ajahn Jaco, he used to do standing meditations. Very hard, but apparently after a while, just standing disappears. There was one of those monks who used to do standing meditation. This was in the jungles, and he was going back one day from from a meeting, walking in the jungle, and a tiger jumped out at him. This is not a joke, this is a real story. A big tiger. Now, even though Ajahn Chah would keep telling me that tigers do not eat monks, but then, you know, I was always skeptical. And I said, how do you know? Because if a tiger ate a monk, the tiger wouldn't confess, and there'd be no monk to complain left. So how do you really know? Where's the evidence? So anyway, I didn't really believe that, but no, obviously this monk didn't either, because as soon as it jumped up in front of him, there was a tiger right in front, and there was a monk standing there, and the only thing he could do is be so incredibly still. And then, when he opened his eyes next time, hours had gone past. He got into a deep meditation, his body just vanished. Not because it went down the tiger's gullet. He wasn't eaten. He just got so perfectly still, because he was forced to. And his body disappeared. There was another monk I know. He didn't face tigers, but what he faced was Thai mosquitoes. This particular monk, he was one of the first monks at that monastery called Wat Nanachat over in Thailand. And Ajahn Chah would come every evening at the beginning to bring some support to that temple. And so all the monks had to meditate, even the Western monks, from about 6 to 8 o'clock, 2-hour meditation, followed by a little bit of chanting and a talk for the villagers to get the villagers to support the monastery. And 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., I knew that time very well. That was called mosquito dinner time. And they'd all come out that time to feed. And remember, being a monk, we didn't have as much protection as you have. You've got hair, no hair at all, bare shoulders and bare arms. And so you could say that we had more seats at the dinner table for the mosquitoes. Not only that, that the mosquitoes, these were Thai mosquitoes, they've been inbred to know they see a brown robe, it's a safe lunch. Anywhere else they go, they get squashed so easily. But monks can't do that. And those mosquitoes really took advantage of you. And I was so kind to those mosquitoes. Sometimes they'd land on your finger. And you say, okay, just take it. It's only a little bit of blood. It's not much. But you know what they would do? They'd put their nose, they put their nose down in your skin. And you know, it's sort of, it doesn't really hurt, but it's just really irritating. It's okay, take as much as you want. There's plenty left for me. And then what that mosquito would do? He would take his nose out, walk somewhere else, and try somewhere else. He didn't like that blood over there, so he tried. It's all the same blood. It goes round and round. It's not different. But those mosquitoes just were so fussy. Go here now, don't like that. Go somewhere else. They give you 3 or 4 bites. They didn't know how lucky they were because of my kindness. We squashed one so easily. I often thought about it, but couldn't do it. Especially when Ajahn Chah was there. And next, that remember that we were some of the first Westerners who went into that part of Thailand. Now, that's just no exaggeration. I went to some parts of the northeast, and I was the first white man they'd ever seen in the village. And big villages, but, you know, quite remote. And so when I went on alms round that morning, you know, you have your bowl, and, you know, the monks, lay people put some rice in the bowl. And the tradition always was, you're not supposed to look at the monk, you know, when you put the food in or the rice in. You're supposed to look in the bowl. But this time, they'd never seen a white man before, let alone a white monk. So they were looking at me. And most of the food fell outside my bowl. The dogs who picked up all of the fallen food, they loved me. They couldn't wait for me to come back again because that was a really big food day for them. But it was the case that, you know, it was a remote part of the world, and so many of those white people hadn't been there, and there's no TVs in there, no electricity. So anyway, in some of those communities, it was not only the first time the villagers had seen a white monk, it was the first time the mosquitoes had eaten Western food. And you know what it's like when a new type of food comes in, it's always a craze. I'm sure they speak to one another, hey guys, there's Western food in that sort of forest over there. And it's monks, so they won't harm you. So the word got around, it must have been something like that, because when we meditate for 2 hours, The mosquitoes would come, and it wouldn't be just two or three. Because I did this with one of my friends, another, he was a monk from California, and we counted them to see how many we could count at the same time on our skin. And this is no exaggeration, you know, because I'm a monk, you have to be honest. Usually about 60 or 70 at one time on your skin. You could even hear them sucking the blood. No, that I couldn't do. But we count them, it's like that many. And that was really hard to endure. And many times you'd open your eyes and see Ajahn Chah just sitting so peacefully. It's really unfair. If he hadn't been there, I'd have run away. But we couldn't. So how do you deal with that? There was no mosquito repellent. No sort of those little smoke coils or mosquito nets there. It was out in the forest, in the rainforest. And then the mosquitoes bite you for 2 hours. So what did I do? There's only one thing a real monk does. And that was to meditate. Forget about the mosquitoes and start just going inside. Make peace with everything. You made peace with everything and soon you went to a nice deep meditation where all of your five senses vanished. How nice that was. I said, whatever you want to have, mosquitoes, you can eat this, eat that, but I'm not going to bother with you. I'm just going to go right inside. And I always like mention that, go inside, not go somewhere else, not run away, which I wanted to do with my legs and run somewhere else. Just stay where you are, go inside this experience, deep inside, and you'll find that soon you can't feel the body. You can't sort of see, you can't hear. You go deep inside, beautiful, peaceful states of mind. When I came out afterwards, you know, when the 2 hours were up, you open your eyes, and you know the weird thing which happened, which I thought, wow, that must have been a very good deep meditation, because I couldn't see any mosquito bites. You know when a mosquito bites you on the skin, a little bump comes up afterwards, and it's a bit itchy. You mustn't scratch those bites, because that can get infected, but just, there was no mosquito bites on me. I thought, ah, the power of samadhi protects you. You have a big force field around you, the anti-mosquito force field. I thought that'd be really cool. And I thought that was what happened for many years until I found out eventually some science papers that mosquitoes, one of the main things that they're attracted to in a human being is their carbon dioxide coming out of their pores. The more carbon dioxide which comes out of your body, the more the mosquitoes know you're there. So if you're metabolizing a lot, if you're really concerned, really worried, oh, I'm going to get dengue fever, oh, I'm going to get malaria, oh, what you're saying is, hey, mosquitoes, over here, I'm here, come over here, come and bite me. Because the more you worry, the more you metabolize, the more carbon dioxide comes out of your skin, the more that mosquitoes can find you. So when you're meditating, you're getting so peaceful, really calm, very peaceful, hardly breathing at all, hardly metabolizing, because you didn't need to, which meant the mosquitoes couldn't find you. Or they went to the monk next to you who was worrying. And so that was an amazing thing which you could do, to go inside and your body just stopped and disappeared. So that is part of our meditation, to find out what this mind is, and all its amazing powers, and what it does. And it's some of these things, you call them powers, they're just really nature, that's all. And this was like low metabolism, so it didn't get sort of bitten by mosquitoes. So it's all about, in meditation, allowing the body to be as comfortable as it possibly can. It can't be perfectly comfortable. I've already mentioned that time when I had the scrub typhus. And that wasn't comfortable at all. It was really low energy. This is one of the second times I'm mentioning when having all these mosquitoes biting you, which was very irritating. Still, you can just let it be. Not react. You didn't have any choice. Reaction was painful. No reaction was freedom. So you just went inside. And when you went inside, all those feelings in the body disappeared. And one of the some of those bodily sensations, like sight, is pretty easy to turn off. You just close your eyes. Now, hearing, I wish I had earlids. If I had earlids, I'd just close them and I wouldn't be able to hear anything. But even if you have earplugs in your ears, you can still hear because of it goes into your, the sound goes into your bones and it gets transferred to your consciousness through other means. So turning off hearing is one of the most difficult to do. In fact, it is the most difficult to do of all the five senses. Smelling and taste, that's easy to turn off. I always say that if you do eat lots of baked beans, you must always sit in the back of the hall. Please don't sit in the front row. Please consider all the people behind you who are going to have to smell what comes out of your backside. So that's one of the reasons why, in those old days, I reckon that why did we always have lots of incense in temples? I think it was always actually to make sure that anything you smelt was incense smell, nothing else. I think that's the reason why. You always have this, sometimes as a Westerner who went to Asia to look at all these traditions. You knew the Buddhist tradition, but some of these other traditions I couldn't really understand. No, like why you kept shoes outside the temple. I know, maybe because it was out dirty, but I know why they don't allow shoes in Buddhist temples now, in places like, you know, Serpentine or in Perth. And it is because if I tell a bad joke, you've got nothing to throw at me. Or why it was, if you haven't heard this story. The other thing, over in Thailand, you know, you light three incense. If you're going to light incense, you put them in there and you bow. When I went to Singapore, Malaysia, the more Chinese tradition, they wouldn't light three incense, they'd light a whole lot and they'd shake it. You see them doing that before they actually put the incense in the bowl? They shake it around and then they put it in. You know why they do that for? Where that custom came from? It took me a long time to figure it out. But where that custom came from was to see that the people who take you to the Buddhist monasteries first, when you're a young girl or a young boy, are the old grandmas. So your old grandma takes you to the temple when you're just a very small girl or a very small boy, and she shows you what to do. So grandma gets some incense and lights it, and she shakes it, not because of it's a tradition, but it's because that she's got Parkinson's. And you think, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do. So you shake it before you put it in. Anyway, that's my theory anyway. I can't see any other reason why you shake it before you put it in. And what else is there? So in order to calm down the five senses and so they can disappear, and just imagine what it must be like if it hasn't happened here. The five senses, you can't see anything, you can't hear, you can't smell, you can't taste. And the body's vanished, you can't feel it. But you're perfectly aware. In other words, all of that energy which is wasted on these five senses is all now focused in the sixth sense of mind. That's energized and that's really beautiful, it's powerful, it's really happy. So that's what we're doing in meditation. Go inside the body. At least most of it. We go the first, just being peaceful, being kind, letting it be still. When it is still, a lot of it disappears. And then we go into time, as I said. Time, past and future, and all those memories of stuff, which are just, I said too much about that already, it's a total waste of time. Instead, let go of the past and go in this wonderful present moment, just being here right now, enjoying this moment. And then, you go into the silence. Stop giving things words and names. That's where knowledge comes from, understanding, wisdom. Not the names, but what was there before the words. So you get into the silence. And then, of course, the last thing in the body which is moving is your breathing. And here, going back to that first friend who was here with me when I came to Perth 36 years ago. We'd only been here a few weeks and somebody came to see us and said they had imported a sensory deprivation chamber into Perth. in one of these little boxes. And in this box, it was obviously watertight, waterproof, because they put warm, salty water. And it was the temperature of your body. And it was salty, so you could float. You just floated in it. And there was no feeling of heat or cold. And there was no pressure on any part of your body. So we could get rid of these all these aches and pains in your physical body. And when they closed the lid, it was a light proof, so you couldn't see anything. And it was soundproof, you couldn't hear anything. They must have had some ventilation in there somehow, so you didn't sort of suffocate. But it was all there to make sure that your five senses could disappear. And he said, would you like to have a go and meditate in one of these? And I said, oh, yeah. But we have like this tradition in Buddhism, the seniors go in there first and the juniors afterwards. So Ajahn Jacaro went in there the first day and I was going to go in there the next day. I was really looking forward to it. But then I asked the next day that someone came to see us and they said, you can't go into that sensory deprivation chamber. Ajahn Jacaro has already been in it, it's quite safe. And that's not the reason why you can't go. Because they showed us a big advertisement in the morning newspaper. First sensory deprivation chambers in Perth, as used by Buddhist monks. It was a scam. They'd asked him to go there so they could advertise and use Ajahn Jacaro's name. So he said, oh, you can't go. And I said, hey, hang on a moment, look. The damage has already been done. I'm not going to add to any damage. Come on, please, 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 please. Can I go? Can I go? He said, no, 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 you can't. Oh, please, no. So I never got to go. But I didn't mind so much because when Ajahn Jacaro, who went in there before I did, he explained to me what it was like. He said, it's so true. You've got no aches and pains on the body at all. It's just you're floating there. And it's your body temperature. You don't feel cold. You don't feel hot. They range the temperature and it's soundproof. You can't, no sounds from outside can come in. Only the sounds from inside. You're breathing. He said when all those other sense impressions were taken away, the breath was so loud. It was the only thing left moving. I thought, that's just like meditation. When you take all the other senses away, what's left? That hasn't stopped moving yet. Which is one of the reasons why the breath meditation is not just the most common object which people choose. It's the most common object which happens naturally. That's why breath meditation is. Because when you're sitting here and you just go inside the silence, the next thing which you'll notice, the lotus leaves of silence just opens up and you can feel the breath. That's still moving. It's the last part of your body awareness before the body vanishes. And so what happens is that you're just aware of the breath. I already mentioned, how's your saliva now? It's not a problem, is it? Because you've diverted attention away. Same with watching the breath. If you go towards watching, if you decide to watch the breath, you decide to watch the breath now, it's never that peaceful. But if you wait until everything else is calmed down, your whole body is relaxed and the breath comes to you, then it's always really nice and peaceful. I don't go looking for my breath. I don't go, I should be aware of my breath. I don't think things like that. I just calm everything down. Go inside my lotus. Go inside body, present moment, silence. And inside the silence, I just stay in the silence until that opens up. Just being kind and aware of silence. It opens up. There's my breath again. Because I don't do it, I don't make it happen. I don't search for it. I don't aim for it. It is not coming from me. is coming from things vanishing and disappearing. I let go of trying to do stuff. I just sit still, peaceful, and then these things happen. And when they do happen, the breath is always really quite nice at the very beginning. And I recognize that. And so what do I do next? Nothing. Just being aware, being kind, which is basically doing nothing. So just aware of being kind to this breath, and it gets very peaceful. Why does it get peaceful? It's the only thing left moving, but I'm not doing very much. I'm not energizing. I'm not sort of taking the energy away by thinking, by planning, by deciding, by making things happen. I'm just very calmly, very peacefully watching with kindness. Which means the breath, because it doesn't need to metabolize very much, the breath gets less and less and less, lighter and lighter and smoother. But one of the things which I always remember to do is actually to remember the happiness and joy. Sometimes people in meditation or maybe spiritual traditions are afraid of happiness. We think, no, this can't be a path. If it's too happy, you'll be attached. Stop smiling. And some people are like that. They think you have to suffer to get enlightened. And it was such a relief to actually not just to follow my instincts, but to actually to check out the suttas, check out the record of how the Buddha taught, and to find places like the, it's called Monuments to the Dhamma, Dhammacaitya Sutta. And this was in the Majjhima Nikaya. The king Pasenadi went to see the Buddha in the Jetavana monastery outside of Sarvati. And he went into the Buddha's room and had a conversation. And part of that conversation, the Buddha asked him, why do you like coming to this monastery so much? And that the king said, because the monks, the Sangha in this monastery are always happy and smiling. Always happy and smiling. Not miserable and fierce. Always happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yes, King. That's what you can expect when people are meditating properly and getting insights. So that's, I think many of you know all my secrets. Know that the fact that actually, you don't know all my secrets. You still haven't found out yet what is in that golden door where that most amazing music came through yet. But anyway, this is a secret. You know, sometimes in interviews, people come up and they say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, I think I just got a jhana. You know what I do? One of the first things I look at is your mouth indicator. If it's level, sorry, that couldn't have been a jhana. If it's a little smile, oh, it's getting better. It's a real, oh, I just got a jhana. Okay, tick that box. It leaves you with a great deal of happiness. Afterglow, you're really, you know, just blissing out. Because that's what it's like. So, anyway, that when you have got that delightful breath, please appreciate it. Actually, I've already given the game away. It's called delightful breath. Breathe in, breathing out, you develop piti and sukha, happiness and joy, with the breath. So the breath is gorgeous. Breathing in. Oh, yeah. Oh, that was a good one. Oh, that's nice. Oh, bring more of those on. That's what it's like without the commentary. If you start saying things like that, you destroy everything, disturb it. It just happens naturally. Your breath appears delightful and beautiful before it disappears. Where does that delight and beauty come from? Now, this is where it comes from. I mentioned I would say something about this in some little hints earlier. As you get more and more peaceful, more and more still, the energy of your being, if you like, starts to go into mindfulness instead of into thinking and doing stuff. Your mindfulness becomes empowered. And I'm sure that that's happened to many of you already, but you may not have noticed it. I did mention it in brief when I said that that first baked bean, just a single bean which I put into my mouth after a meditation retreat, oh, that was amazing. I've tasted many baked beans since and they tasted nothing like that, unless I've just come out of a deep meditation. What the heck is going on? The first time this sort of thing happened to me was when I did my first meditation retreat, still as a student at Cambridge. This was in boarding houses. This was during the vacation period. All the students had gone here, they're all over the place, so we hired two or three boarding houses, and that was where we were going to run our retreat for 9 days. And if you probably all heard about English cooking in those days. And of all the chefs and cooks in England, the very worst, the bottom of the pile, which could not get a job anywhere else in the whole kingdom, or queendom, whatever you call it, were the ones who fed poor students. So when I heard that we're going to eat boarding house food for 9 days, I really thought to bring some sandwiches or something. It was disgusting food. But nevertheless, you never know until you actually try. And the first meal was delicious. I thought, wow. You know, my karma, I always think I got really good karma. I must have got the best boarding house cook in the whole of the world. You know, they should be working for a restaurant, not for poor, impoverished students. And so I really enjoyed the food. I didn't bother about sandwiches. It was lovely food. I wondered why. And also, when I went over to, we had allowed to have a walk for 1 hour every morning. It's actually before breakfast, early in the morning, summertime, nice time. Because I knew the area, I went to the Botanical Gardens, the Cambridge Botanical Gardens, not that far away. And so when I went into the Botanical Gardens, I was supposed to be for exercise. He was sitting down all day and doing things slowly, get some exercise. And when I went to the entrance of the Botanical Gardens, at the very, it was that back entrance, there was this clump of bamboo. Wow. That was an incredible clump of bamboo. It was gorgeous. It was beautiful. And I started to contemplate. That is why they use bamboo in Chinese watercolors. It always has some bamboo there somewhere. It's very subdued. All its colors are very light. And just the shape of it. It's slender. It's a long stalk of bamboo which bends just under its own weight. So graceful. It's a beautiful, almost perfect curve. And even the leaves, they're not these big fat leaves like, you know, Western trees. They're very slender and come to a point at the end. And I thought, wow, that's an amazing clump of bamboo. And I was standing there looking at it for about 10 or 15 minutes, as I remember. And I thought, if people see me, they'll take me away. It's the trouble with being a monk, because sometimes, you know, you're not usual. And I was not a monk yet, but even so, just sitting there looking at a clump of bamboo, if somebody saw me, they'd of course someone to take me away. But I do recall here that well, the first weeks I was in Perth, one of the visitors, he was a Nepalese man, unfortunately he had an epileptic fit. So we called the ambulance. And the ambulance came in plenty of time, because this was in North Perth, not that distance from all the hospitals. And so they came and they looked at him. And one of the questions they asked was, what day of the week was it? He didn't know, and so they put him in the ambulance. And then I asked him just before, you know, they took him away, he said, why did you ask that question in particular, what day of the week it is? I said, that's a standard question we ask. You know, because you know, everybody knows what day of the week it is, and if they don't, they're in the back and going to the to Greylands Hospital. Oh my goodness. Because I didn't know what day of the week it was. I mean, just a monk, you don't care. It's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they're all the same when you don't go to work. So from that time on, I made a point, I must know what day of the week it is. So to let you know, it's Monday today.
Mondays, so if somebody comes in an ambulance, they ask, what day of the week is it? It's Monday. Okay. I think it is, isn't it? Okay, yeah, thank you. So anyway, I was standing there looking at this clump of bamboo like some crazy person, and I thought, I can't carry on like this, but I don't want to leave the bamboo. I haven't finished with it yet. So there was a seat. So I sat down. If you sit down on a seat and stare at something, that's okay in England. If you stand up and stare, that's really off. I don't know why. But anyway, that's the way of things. So I sat down and stared at the clump of bamboo. So I have to go. I'm going to get some breakfast. So I'll come back the next day. 8 days I went back there. 8 days I sat down and stared at that clump of bamboo, and it was such a beautiful piece of bamboo. Oh, I just enjoyed it so much. This is a pretty 100% accurate story. And after the retreat was finished, back to studies, messing around, like as a student does, I had a free afternoon. I thought, wow, I'm going to go and see the most beautiful piece of bamboo in the world. I got on my little bicycle and went down to Bateman Street. I still remember the name of the street. Back entrance to the Botanical Gardens, and there's the bench. Sat down, looked at my clump of bamboo. It was so dry and desiccated, and just, it wasn't beautiful at all. And I thought, you know, bamboo in England and that type of climate, it's not meant for that type of climate. And I looked at it, and it was just really something very sickly, weak. And I thought, where's the beauty gone? How come those cooks, who weren't very good cooks, how come I could really enjoy their food? The beauty, the delight wasn't in the food. The beauty and delight was in my mind, which I added to that clump of bamboo. It was, for those of you who know your Buddhism and know Anapanasati, it's a citta sankhara. You're seeing that through your mind, and it's gorgeous. And there's so many other things. Okay, I'm going to tell the gross story now. If you don't like gross stories, you can leave. There it comes. Some of you know what it is. But this is almost extreme. But, you know, it was true. Teaching a retreat here in Jhana Grove a few years ago. Sometimes I meditate here, sometimes I meditate in my room. Get aircon in there. When I meditate in, I was meditating here, and eventually, you know, you had to go to the toilet. Even monks have to go to the toilet, you know. So I went in the male toilet opposite the laundry. It was the middle room. There's, you know, three cubicles there. I always thought of putting a plaque in there somewhere. This is where that happened, because many people know this story. It should be heritage anyway. You should never, never, ever remove that toilet bowl and change it for something, you know, more high-tech. So I did what we call a number two. Number one is urine, number two is the other one. And I made a mistake. My mistake was to look in the bowl before flushing. And I looked in the bowl. Wow. That was amazing what I'd just done. I looked, first of all, at its shape. Have you ever looked at it and admired the shape? All these little balls which have been pushed together. And it was like a sculpture, like some Rodin or Michelangelo had actually visualized this. And it was perfectly balanced, is the shape, the thicknesses, and just how it was elongated. And it was, honestly, it was a work of art. And then going past the shape to the colours. It wasn't just one brown. It was so many different shades of brown and how they just all interact together. And this is the thing with colour and shape. It's just how they interact together. And the effect they had was a most beautiful sort of sculpture painted in just really raw, deep colours. And then the fragrance. Now, I know many people, they use, you know, deodorants and scents And as a monk, sometimes people, you meet all sorts of people. You know, you meet the Queen of England and meet sort of pop stars and stuff. And this was something, you smell all these scents which, you know, people wear. But this was something real, deep. You know, it spoke of the depth of, you know, humanity. It was inside of everybody. It was just beautiful. And it just filled all of my sensory organs up with delight. It was the most delightful piece of shit I've ever made. Oops, I've said it. And I was literally in that cubicle for quite a few minutes going, wow, look at that. That's amazing. Wow. And every time I looked, it just got more and more beautiful. I could see so much more. There's incredible things happening in there. And that the thought came up, I'm going to take this up and show my friends. Even bring it here. In fact, say, hey, look at this. Isn't this marvelous? And I realized, at some time, I said, no, I shouldn't do that. I have to let it go. Oh, I can't. You have to let it go. Flush it away. Oh, do I have to? And if I hadn't been a monk for such a long time, used to letting go, and used to abandoning things which are most beautiful. Okay, so I'll put my finger on the top. No, I can't do it. Oh, no. No, I can't. Man, I pressed the button quickly. And one of the most beautiful things which had ever come out of my back hole vanished forever. I think I still got some grief over that. No, I think I'm exaggerating there. But at the time, it was really beautiful and gorgeous. Why? The same way a clump of bamboo in the wrong climate looked beautiful. The same way boarding house food was delicious. The same reason why your breath is the most delightful breath you've ever breathed in your whole existence. Your mind is getting empowered. Powerful mindfulness, superpower mindfulness. Whatever you look is gorgeous. Now I quote William Blake, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand. An eternity in an hour. That was his 17th century British painter and poet, philosopher. And that's one of the verses which I always remembered. See a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour. That to me was just a description of what superpower mindfulness is like. You see the beautiful bamboo flooring. So much going on in there. A heaven, a world. Just in that little piece of wood right in front of me. To put your hands, your head up and see a meditator in front of you. It's incredible stuff inside of them. Amazing beauty and power and stuff. So you go to prison and you meet a murderer. They're not a murderer. They're a person who's murdered somebody. They're huge, much more than those outer descriptions. And you look at yourself, this stupid old monk who tells the same old jokes every time. Well, not the same old ones, they're just adapted a little bit. But you look at that, you see so much beauty inside. Self-love. As you look at other people, it's not better than anybody else. See the beauty in so many things in life. You go outside and you see a blade of grass, and you look at it and keep on looking and keep on looking, and it becomes so green, deeply green, and so many different shades of green in just one blade of grass. And its shape, you touch its texture and it blows your mind. Amazing what's going on there. Because you now are mindful. You see so much more in things. you're awake. And then you cross your legs, close your eyes, and you go very deep. And when you get to see your breathing, whoa. It's so gorgeous that you can't be disturbed. Time to go for breakfast or for lunch. You're still sitting there. And people sometimes tap you on the shoulder and say, lunch. And no, no thank you. I'd rather carry on watching this gorgeous breath. And of course, this is just starting off the delightful breath, the delightful meditations. And of course, the delight gets so strong, the breath disappears. It's the delight which you see appears as the most powerful sense of a human being, the sense of sight. You interpret it, you visualize it as a physical light inside your mind. Beautiful. One of the signs of nimittas, this is nimitta land now, deep inside the lotus, most gorgeous petals. Inside that lotus, those nimittas, one of the very clear characteristics, if they are, say, whatever colour they happen to be, say like a blue, it's more blue than any blue you've ever seen in this world. If it's yellow, it's more yellow than any yellow. It's as if those colours have been purified. Purified to an extent you've never experienced before, but stands out. Even if it's white, it's whiter than white. Deep, brilliant, beautiful. And of course, because it's delightful, you know that delight is one of the most important parts of that. It's happy, it's joyful, you're having a wonderful time. And it's very powerful. Your mindfulness is really increasing. And I'll say more about this later on, but when it gets that delightful, you cannot be taken away from it. Very difficult to come out. To the point that you just go deeply in to where you are. And the body is now gone for you, for this meditation period. And you can't feel the body. Mosquitoes can bite you. You know, actually they don't even find you. And people can ring the bell, you don't hear it. You're happily deep inside, enjoying yourself. If ever that happens to you, I was going to say, don't worry about it. You've got no choice. You know, you just go deep inside. You can eat something later on. You know, we always got lots of food inside of us, stored up energy. So don't worry about having to eat. The joy, the bliss of the deep meditations more than compensate. You have a wonderful time. Beautiful experiences of meditation. And of course, that's what I would like for each one of you. You get incredible bliss when your body vanishes and you get some really understanding why we do this meditation. What about the insights we come? Oh, we get huge insights from this. But those insights I would explain another time, another place. Sadhu. 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 Always try and do things a little bit different every time. Okay, have some nice meditation. The danger with what I've been saying, of course, oh, I want some of that. If you try and crave and want something, you'll never get it. If you let go of craving and try Ananda method, remember Ananda method I said last night? Go to bed. It didn't work, but well, try again. So have a nice time.